As commented on earlier in the program by Dr. Hurwitz and discussed by Principal Investigator Dr. Amory DeGramont on our last issue, the most recent update in the Mosaic trial was presented by Dr. DeGramont at the June ASCO meeting in Chicago, and I asked Dr. Richard Goldberg to comment on these findings and related data sets also presented at ASCO on the ACCENT database by Dr. Dan Sargent, who also commented on this in our last issue. Dr. Goldberg reviewed these findings.
Prior to this, we've just had disease-free survival data. Now we have significant advantage for overall survival at 6 years. One of the points that's interesting is it is taking longer, perhaps, for our studies to mature. And the data that Dan Sargent has presented us with from the ACCENT trials, that the most common recurrences are in the second and third year, may actually be changing as we get more effective treatment that isn't necessarily curative for somebody, but is more effective at cytoreducing, so it takes longer for the disease to come back. The good news was that the stage 3 patients definitely had about a 6% survival advantage. The bad news was that the stage 2 patients didn't seem to have any survival advantage, really, with FOLFOX over 5-FU leucovorin. So what does that mean? Well, I think for all comers with stage 2 disease, the guidelines from ASCO still really apply. You need to have an individualized discussion with the patient, tell them what they can expect, ask them whether that's enough for them to take treatment. My own thought was, I'm always on the fence whether to offer FOLFOX or 5-FU leucovorin to stage 2 patients who want treatment. The data from the Mosaic this year suggests to me that maybe we're better off just offering them 5-FU leucovorin.
What about the toxicity data that's come out over the last, year or so in terms of longer-term toxicity with the use of oxaliplatin in the adjuvant setting?
Well, the main residual toxicity remains the neuropathy, and certainly you talk to patients years later and they still are not quite normal. They usually are better, but it is a long-term toxicity that people have to endure. And fortunately, we haven't seen any of the toxicities like are seen in breast cancer where people get heart failure or permanent toxicity that doesn't go away in terms of neurotoxicity or second malignancies. I think the neuropathy is an uncomfortable but not limiting toxicity in terms of using these drugs. The other thing I would say is that I take some heart from the FLOX trial, the C07 trial, where instead of giving over 1,000 milligrams per meter squared of oxali, you gave about 750 milligrams per meter squared. I'm pretty quick to stop oxaliplatin in the adjuvant setting when people start to get neuropathy. And I don't wait till they have neuropathy that extends from day 1 to day 14. Usually what I'll observe is I'll start to say, well, before I used to get it on day 1, now I'm getting it to day 3, and then the next time it's day 5, they start getting neuropathy that goes to day 7 or day 8, I'm thinking about taking them off the drug. And I don't dose reduce it, I just stop it.
How do you approach the issue of adjuvant therapy in the older patient, 65, 75, 85, 90 years old patient?
Well, as you know, I did a meta-analysis with Dan Sargent and others of a number of trials, 4 different trials, looking at people older than 70 compared to those younger than 70. We looked at the Mosaic trial. We looked at 2 first-line advanced disease trials, 9741 and the DeGramont original study. And then we looked at the Rothenberg trial in second line. And really what we found across the board in all 3 settings was that patients benefited equally regardless of age. Toxicity was minimally elevated, and it was white blood count and thrombocytopenia that was affected. And these were laboratory parameters, not clinical parameters. And except for in the second line setting, there was an advantage of equal value to younger and older patients in terms of the superior FOLFOX therapy.
That now, was looking at a breakdown at plus or below 70.
Right.
How many people did you have over 80 or 85 there?
We didn't have very many. The people that were enrolled in these trials were the best of the older patients. And taking the data that we have from them and applying them to the patient that walks in your office every day is a little more complicated. But my hope is that this study will free oncologists to think more liberally about the use of FOLFOX in older patients. And the other thing that I like to tell people is in my own practice, if I'm worried about somebody, I'll start them off on LV5FU2. If they tolerate that, fine. I'll either go up to full-dose oxaliplatin, or if I'm being cautious, I'll give them 60 milligrams per meter squared of oxali the first time. And if they pass that test, then I'll go up to full dose. So I don't think that when you first see the patient, you have to make a decision, I'm going to give them full Fox or I'm going to give them just 5-FU. I think you can say I'm going to start with full Fox, and if they pass the hurdles that I put in front of them without tripping over them, then I'll be more aggressive.
What about in the 80-plus patient, 85, 90-year-old? Is there a limit, age limit, when you will stop giving adjuvant therapy?
I think that if a patient has comorbidities that suggest to me that they likely aren't going to live for more than 2 or 3 years, that it's reasonable not to do it. I'll give you two examples from my practice. You know, I've treated a 90-year-old who's now 92 who took FOLFOX adjuvant, and even though she walked with a walker because of arthritis, you know, she was somebody who was going to the pool and doing pool aerobics every day. She went to the senior citizen center. She was active within the limits of her arthritis. I saw another patient who was in her mid-80s, and we made a decision not to treat her, and now I'm using FOLFOX to treat her for advanced disease and wishing that I had treated her in the adjuvant setting because she had a high risk for recurrence cancer. Now, maybe she would have recurred anyway, but, you know, we're at the same point using the same drug. She's 2 years older, and I'm using it with palliative intent rather than curative intent. So,
where are we in terms of clinical trials in the adjuvant setting? Which trials are up right now, and where are they?
Well, the one trial that's open in the U.S. is the N0147 study, which is FOLFOX plus or minus cetuximab. I believe that that's an important trial. It's about a third of the way through to its final accrual, so it's making progress. The accrual has picked up since the NSABP trial closed. The NSABP currently doesn't have a study open. They've endorsed N0147. So this is actually an historic time in the U.S. We have one trial open in all the groups nationally. And I think that this is an important question to ask and an important question to answer. Beyond that, it isn't clear to me what the next chemotherapy biologic question ought to be. There had been some discussion about 5 drugs versus 4, so FOLFOX plus bevacizumab plus or minus cetuximab. My experience has been in the 80405 advanced disease study on patients that I've enrolled in that trial. The ones who get randomized to 5 drugs have a hard time being treated to progression. Most of them have had responses, but most of them have said uncle before they've gotten potentially maximum benefit.
What is it in particular that seems to be affecting these people?
Well, they'll get some of the neurotoxicity, they'll get a lot of fatigue, and of course, they get the rash. And so I think between those three things, when you get any one of them, it's bad. When you get all three of them together, I think it becomes unbearable. And these are even for macho guys in their 40s who are not used to quitting because of physical things.
How is the rash playing out in the adjuvant setting in the intergroup trial with looking at FOLFOX cetuximab? How do people kind of respond when they get that?
They don't like it. You know, it used to be that the badge of chemotherapy was hair loss. Now the badge in colorectal cancer with oxaliplatin instead of irinotecan isn't hair loss, it's rash. And the rash is unsightly. And, you know, I was recently at a meeting where an advocate spoke who was getting cetuximab, and she said, you know, it isn't just a rash on my face. I'm uncomfortable everywhere. The things that line my skin and other parts of me are uncomfortable. And it's not any fun, but I don't have an alternative.
What is being discussed right now in terms of the next adjuvant trial?
This is actually a time when we may have a chance to think outside the box a little bit. And by that, I mean it isn't clear what the next drug is going to be that we ought to add on top of FOLFOX until we have the data back from the bevacizumab and cetuximab trials. And so I'm intrigued with the data that Jeff Meyerhardt and Charlie Fuchs have put forward on both diet and physical activity as potentially preventive of recurrence. And the magnitude of the benefit is substantial, at least in the retrospective studies that have been done. So we talked today about the possibility of designing a trial that would have FOLFOX plus either dietary and physical activity intervention or not. And, you know, the other question is, should you throw a little aspirin in besides? So I think there's an opportunity to look at some things that patients would probably find appealing. Every time I have a conversation with somebody about what I recommend for treatment, it seems like at the end they're going to say to me, you know, what should I do about complementary medicine? Is there anything I should eat or shouldn't eat? What about activity? So I think patients have a big interest in this. One of the big questions is, can you get them to reliably change lifestyle by counseling? And there's some studies in breast cancer and other places that suggest maybe you can.
And I guess, I mean, patients are really interested in reducing their risk of recurrence. You know, one other thing I want to ask you about in terms of adjuvant therapy, some interesting stuff came out at ASCO about this, is the issue of adequacy of nodal dissection. Mm-hmm. And we've been hearing about that for a few years, but there were some things that came out at ASCO that were particularly interested about that issue. Can you talk about where we're at with that right now?
Well, I think we're pretty well decided that you need to have at least 12 lymph nodes in order to be comfortable that you have adequate sampling. I've raised the question a number of times, is lymph node dissection therapeutic or is it just a valuable prognostic tool? And I think we can answer the question that it's certainly a valuable prognostic tool at this point. I don't know if or how it could be therapeutic, but clearly people that have more negative nodes have better outcomes. Why that is, I don't know.
I mean, it kind of makes intuitive sense, though, that if you only examine a few nodes, you might be missing some positive nodes, you know?
Right. And, you know, it may well be that in colon cancer, if you leave behind microscopic deposits in two nodes, that that's what ends up coming back to kill the patient.
Do you have any feel for where the problem is in terms of nodal dissection? There's this big debate about, is it the surgery, is it the pathology, or is it both?
Well, I think it can be either. One of the questions that I have is, is the podium pounded at surgical meetings about nodal dissection the same way it's pounded at the ASCO meeting and at medical oncology meetings? And I don't know the answer to that. There's clear data that we discussed earlier today that cancer centers with oncologic surgeons get a better node harvest than do community centers. Is that a problem we can't fix? I think it's a fixable problem. I think doctors want to do the best they can for their patients, and if you can indicate to them how important it is and how to do it, that they'll, in general, try and do the best they can.
I've been impressed by how many doctors, both investigators as well as docs in practice, say that when we push our pathologists, when we get less than adequate number of nodes, and we say to the pathologists, go find nodes, what I hear is they always find them.
Yeah.
So even if it is a surgical problem, it kind of seems like maybe we can solve it with a pathologist. Does that sound logical?
Well, I think in part we can. They have to have an adequate number of nodes given to them before they can find an adequate number of nodes in the specimen. You know, my worry is that if we make it too hard on them, they'll stop by the autopsy room and get a pocket full of nodes.
But, you know, it was kind of shocking, though. I wasn't aware of the data, I mean, from the SEER database showing, and was presented again at ASCO, that half the patients in the SEER database who have less than 12 positive nodes, and yet when the NCCN centers looked at their patients, it was 11%.
That doesn't surprise me, because in most of the NCCN centers, you've got oncologic surgeons and colorectal surgeons doing this, and they've had it beaten into them in their fellowships that adequate resections for cancer are the rule. In many other centers, you've got general surgeons, many of whom were trained in the time before people really specialized in one type of surgery or another. Those people have been the salvation of small towns. You know, one part of the day they'll do an aortic aneurysm, and then they'll do a colon cancer, and next they'll take out a gallbladder. And as a consequence, just like a general oncologist, they have a lot of things to keep up on. So if we can get an educational message out there, I'll bet they'll keep up on this too.
Let's talk a little bit about management of metastatic disease and start with a first-line setting. Any databases that have come out now in the last 6 months or a year that you think are important for oncologists to know about?
This year's ASCO was a little confusing, I would say. A couple of years ago, we had these clear signals that were emerging about bevacizumab with IFL from the Hurwitz trial, and at least titillating signals from the ACROBAT trial that showed a 70% response rate when you added cetuximab to first-line chemotherapy. And now we're beginning to see the comparative studies being done with better regimens, FOLFOX and FOLFIRI or CAPOX. And we're finding that the results aren't what we had hoped and expected. Now, having said that, the CRYSTAL trial was positive and did show a benefit for the addition of cetuximab to FOLFIRI, and the smaller OPUS trial showed what looks like it'll be a benefit to FOLFOX plus cetuximab. But we were hoping for 4 and 5 month differences in terms of overall survival, and we didn't see that. We saw 1 month differences. Now, why is that? I think it's a little bit hard to explain. One of the theories that I have about it is that it's hard to exploit the potential benefit of these regimens when you're limited by oxaliplatin neurotoxicity. So if you are finding that patients after 6 or 7 months of treatment are likely to come off of oxaliplatin because of neurotox, and progression-free survival is going to be 11 or 12 months if you could continue treating them, then you may not be really optimizing your use of the drugs. And I think that the approach of the OptimOx 1 study, where people fell back to just a 5-FU leucovorin, and in this circumstance it would be 5-FU leucovorin plus Bev or cetuximab, is probably a better strategy, and that we've learned something from these studies that hopefully will help us design better studies in the future.
Can you talk a little bit more about the findings from the CRYSTAL trial and whether you think it's legitimate to do an indirect comparison to that, to some of the trials looking at FOLFOX plus bevacizumab?
Well, you know, we always do these comparisons in our heads, and there's now a whole industry. You know, Cochrane does comparisons, and people are doing meta-analyses all the time. I think meta-analysis has a benefit. Pooling large groups of data hopefully erases the differences between the data sets. But it is also hazardous because, you know, in one study you may be using progression-free survival, another you may be using disease-free survival, and entry criteria may be different. I think toxicity management criteria may be different. And so cross-study comparisons do have hazards, and I think we have to keep that in our minds.
Can you talk a little bit about the decision for first-line therapy and how you sorted through in terms of the various options?
Well, I still try and get patients who are willing to go on the 80405 trial, which is a study of dealer's choice, FOLFOX or FOLFIRI, with either cetuximab, bevacizumab, or both. If a patient doesn't want that, then I'll give them a talk about how FOLFOX and FOLFIRI pretty much provide equivalent outcomes, and that in general we're adding bevacizumab to first-line therapy. I don't think that what I heard at ASCO is going to change my first-line approach off study. I'm still probably going to offer people FOLFOX plus bevacizumab first-line.
What about side effects and toxicity issues, FOLFOX versus FOLFIRI, Bev versus cetuximab?
Well, FOLFOX versus FOLFIRI, I think we have very clear data about that. You trade neuropathy and neutropenia with FOLFOX for alopecia and GI side effects for FOLFIRI. And, you know, I believe that both of them are reasonably tolerable but toxic combinations. I still think they're worth it. If I had colon cancer or advanced colon cancer, I'd certainly take combination therapy. That's another issue that I think is worth talking about. We have a second trial to add to the FOCUS trial, which is the CAIRO trial, a Dutch study, where single agent was compared to combination therapy. And in both of those studies, single agent looked as good as combination.
Single agent being what?
It was 5-FU leucovorin.
Versus?
Versus FOLFOX or FOLFIRI, and the FOCUS had both. And, you know, in both of those studies, the median survivals were between 13 and 17 months. And we're seeing study after study now with median survivals over 20 months. So I'm still a strong proponent of combination therapy.
What are some of the new agents coming out right now that you think are going to have some promise as we move forward in this disease?
Well, that's a little bit of a conundrum at this point. I think in the last two ASCOs, we've had reports and lack of reports that don't make it clear what's going to be the next big winner in colorectal cancer. There are lots of different drugs out there, antibodies as well as small molecules. Some of them look like they may be real drugs. Some of them look like they may be just flashes in the pan. And I think it's very hard to sort out which ones or one will end up being the next approvable drug in colorectal cancer.
Do you think that the way we're going about looking at this is optimal, or that we're not going to get answers to these questions?
You know, I think we ought to take a lesson from the CONFIRM 1 and CONFIRM 2 trials, which you'll remember were chemotherapy plus or minus PTK, where you could argue that the lack of a randomized phase 2 study or any phase 2 study with that combination led to the accrual of a couple of thousand patients into trials that turned out to not meet their endpoints. And so I believe that we ought to be looking for signals in phase 1, and then we ought to be doing phase 2s. And nowadays, when we see so much variability in median survivals across trials, I believe it's worth it to do randomized phase 2 studies when you're trying to make a go, no-go decision for a phase 3. You know, a typical phase 3 study costs tens of millions of dollars and enrolls hundreds and now thousands of patients. And I think we need to marshal our resources, both our patient resources and our fiscal resources, to do the best studies that we possibly can.
Do you think there's any lesson in the sorafenib hepatoma story in that they really didn't see very much in phase 2 and then they saw these great results with this phase 3 trial that was just presented?
You know, that's an interesting question too. I believe that points out the difference in the models when you're looking at small molecules versus chemotherapy drugs, where you may be seeing a more cytostatic rather than cytotoxic outcome. Was that a bit of a shot in the dark? I think it was a bit of a shot in the dark, but they hit the target.
What about rectal cancer? Where are we in that disease, and what are some of the trials going on right now that you think are going to yield some important results for the future?
Well, on rectal cancer, the pre-op chemotherapy and radiation seems to have essentially become the MO for most patients. The only ones that I would say where that isn't the case is if you've got an early lesion like a T2N0, or some would even say a T3N0 lesion. The next step, I think, is to try and add sensitizers to 5-FU. There have been lots and lots of studies looking at all of the drugs that are active in advanced disease as radiation sensitizers. The NSABP trial that's looking at capecitabine versus 5-FU plus or minus oxaliplatin, I think, is a very important study. And that'll help us know whether adding a second radiation sensitizer preoperatively will be useful. The intriguing data from Chris Willett on bevacizumab obviously needs to be looked at in a larger patient population. The data about cetuximab that came from the head and neck docs with radiation is intriguing, but we had a study that was presented by the German rectal group, a very reliable group, showing that cetuximab actually didn't look like a good radiation sensitizer in rectal cancer. So, you know, I am seeing patients for second opinions or after metastatic disease that are getting 5-FU and oxaliplatin now as a radiation sensitizer, and I think that's premature. I'm not doing that in my practice. I'm trying to enroll people on the R04 trial.
I guess where I've heard people talking about is with bulky tumors, young, healthy patients. What
right.
do you think about that?
Well, I want to do the best I can for my patients too, but I don't know that oxaliplatin does better for them than 5-FU as a radiation sensitizer. So I have not really been doing that off study.
What do you think about the data that's out there, phase 2 data, et cetera, looking at oxali in this setting?
Well, I'm hopeful that the R04 trial is going to be positive, but I don't know that it is.
How do you approach the issue of post-op therapy in the patient with rectal cancer, adjuvant therapy?
I make my decision before they go to the operating room, and generally anybody who's node positive, I'm going to treat regardless, and the node positive may be on the basis of an endoscopic ultrasound with or without aspiration or an MRI. And, you know, I find that after somebody's had pre-op chemo-rads, that often I can't get FOLFOX into them for 6 months. So I'm often stopping at 4 months, sort of taking that from the O'Connell data where they just used 5-FU in the earlier rectal trials. They get neutropenic and they get thrombocytopenic because their bone marrow is beat up. You know, you're irradiating about 24% of bone marrow when you do the usual pelvic ports that it takes to radiate rectal cancer adequately.
Any other trials out there right now in rectal cancer that you think maybe are going to bear some fruit in the future?
There's an exciting trial that the American College of Surgeons Oncology Group has just gotten approved for laparoscopic versus conventional resection of rectal cancer. That has certainly been validated in colon cancer. There's some advantages to laparoscopic surgery in the pelvis in terms of getting a good resection with sharp planes and doing a total mesorectal excision. So I think that that study should accrue well and should be a definitive trial.
Have you seen any patients who've had laparoscopic rectal surgery?
I have not yet, no.